I think that balloon, we need a different name for that thing. It doesn't sound like spy gear.
It's too happy, too birthday yeah. party.
It's a dirigible or something. I mean, a balloon just seems kind of ridiculous.
It has a very 1930s feel to it. You know, it's like, you know, like, oh, you know, the Germans have launched a balloon over Montana.
Yeah.
Well, I assume we have our own balloons, which may be why we're not shooting it down or something floating over China.
Yeah, I think it's safe to assume that whatever the Chinese are using, we've got something. But yeah, I think you shoot down their balloon, then what happens to ours, I guess. But
you know, they shouldn't have chosen Montana. There are a lot of guns in Montana. There are a lot of people who can do their own shooting, probably.
It is bird hunting season in some places, so the balloon should have its affairs in order, I think.
Welcome to The Political Scene, a weekly discussion about the big questions in American politics. I'm Jane Mayer, and I'm joined by my colleagues Evan Osnos and Susan Glasser. Hi.
Hi, Jane.
Hey there. Great to be with you.
Hey, guys.
Look, it is time for a new generation. It is time for more leadership. It is time for the fact that we really start to take our country back. We cannot have another term of Joe Biden. And we have to remember, too, we have lost the last 7 out of 8 popular votes for president. It is time that we get a Republican in there that can lead and that can win a general election.
Well, it seems that Nikki Haley is running for president. She's joining a relatively small Republican field so far. There's definitely the defeated former President Donald Trump, probably Ron DeSantis, and more than a few maybes, including the Mikes, Pence and Pompeo. So today, we're going to take a look at the key candidates, what they stand for, where they're turning for money, and what all this tells us about the current state of the GOP. We should open any conversation about this state in the presidential cycle with the perpetual lament about the perpetual campaign. I'll put this to both of you. Why does it take 2 years to run for president in this country? How did this happen?
Well, you know, Jane, the truth is that this is actually going to be a shorter campaign than the last couple presidential cycles. That's the thing that really leaps out to the kind of Washington campaign class, is that at this time in the 2016 cycle, you had a huge field full of would-be contenders. In the end, I think there were something like 17 Republicans ran against Donald Trump, as we all famously know, in the 2016 campaign. Even during the 2020 primary campaign among the Democrats, you had a huge number of Democrats who had already announced by this period of time and were jostling with each other pretty actively already for the right to face off against Donald Trump. To me, what's notable is that, you know, I'll say it again and again and again, but, you know, you got to beat Donald Trump with somebody. And for all of the energy over the last couple months suggesting, well, you know, the air has finally gone out of Donald Trump's tires, in the end, he is still a front runner in the polls. And it's not entirely clear who exactly is going to run against him. So you got to consider him the leader in the race so far, since he's really not running against anybody yet. And by the way, Nikki Haley, the one candidate who's about to announce later this month, is firmly in the single digits. And it's fair to say that's probably where she's going to stay.
So, Evan, does it actually seem kind of like a slow starter here for you and a late start?
Well, it's certainly a late start, later than usual. And I think all of us are kind of bracing for the ordeal that is going to be the next couple of years. I mean, there's just something kind of grueling about it. And it goes through these periods when people tune out entirely. And yet, and I will say also, coming from having been overseas, where, you know, in places like Japan, the law actually says that a campaign is 12 days long. And you go to the UK and it's sort of a much more reasonable scale. And yet, and I almost can't believe I'm saying this out loud, I think there is something fundamentally useful about a campaign, because it really does put these candidates through the ringer, and it allows the public to assess who is ready. I mean, who's done the reading? Who is now? It doesn't work all the time. God knows we have recent presidents who prove the rule, but it allows at least the public in this giant country to get a look at these people and to decide up close, in some cases, whether or not they are ready for the job. But I would put the question to you, Jane, too, which is, as you know better than anybody, one of the reasons why these campaigns are so long is because of money. And the money drives the scale and the kind of constant inflation of how big these things have become, does it not?
Yeah, no. You know, there's so much money in American politics at this point that it's become a professionalized business. It's not just a campaign. It's a whole profession of consultants and pollsters and TV stations that live off of the advertisements and everything else. I mean, it's permanent partly because it's a complete income for a zillion people every 4 years just for the presidential campaigns. But anyway, let's talk about Nikki Haley. So she's the former governor of South Carolina, former UN ambassador, and she boasts that she's never lost an election race that she's been in, and she's not going to lose this one now. What do you think her reputation in Washington is like? Is she seen as a rising star?
Well, I think, you know, she is one of the many former Trump cabinet members who now are considering running against him, while at the same time continuing to play this awkward dance. The thing that I really think about Nikki Haley is that I don't know what to think about Nikki Haley because she changes her mind so often, at least when it comes to the subject of Donald Trump. She's been, I think, for me, one of the most fascinating case studies of what I call the dance of the enablers, right? She was against Donald Trump ever so hesitantly after January 6th when it seemed as though the Republican Party was going to break that way. Then she actually not only reversed herself, but she said, I will not run if Donald Trump is running for the 2024 presidential nomination. And then, of course, that is no longer an operative statement now that it appears once again that the political support is ebbing away from Donald Trump. So, you know, she's certainly a very nimble politician, shall we say, in her view. She's a very strong campaigner. She's a strong talker. She has an interesting record as governor of South Carolina. She was the person who is well known not only for appointing the state's first African-American Republican Senator, Tim Scott, but also presiding over the law to eliminate the Confederate flag flying over the statehouse in South Carolina. She is a daughter of Indian immigrants, you know, so she's got a very appealing political profile. She's much more hawkish, by the way, much more of a traditional Republican than Donald Trump. And so I think she'll stake out that lane to a certain extent. But, you know, the most pithy one-liner I've heard about Nikki Haley's campaign that kind of sums it up is that, you know, she's out there first in the very heated campaign to run for vice president. And I do think that her odds are probably better of becoming vice president at this point than president.
I have to wonder, I mean, I have to agree and wonder if, is the Republican Party going to be the place at this point in time that would elect not just a woman, but a woman of color from an immigrant family to be president at a point when they're waging a culture war on race issues and leading a backlash against feminism in many ways. I just, it's kind of hard to imagine, though. I have to say one thing that's been interesting to me watching her is the money behind her. She has a nonprofit group that is a dark money group, and an organization called Documented got a hold of some of the paperwork on it and could see some of the donors, even though they were supposed to be secret. And she's got some of the big Wall Street traditional GOP money bags behind her, including it was at the time Sheldon Adelson was still alive that this came out, and his wife Miriam, and Paul Singer, and Stanley Druckenmiller, you know, big New York money people. Still, I don't know. I really wonder, you know, Evan, do you see her as playing to the sort of the populist wing of the party?
I think she will play to whichever part of the party seems most relevant to her at the time. I mean, as Susan described so well, the challenge of Nikki Haley is knowing what she stands for because she's been all over the place over the course of her career. But in a curious way, that's also her strength because she is not to be underestimated politically. I mean, if you go back, it's worth just pointing out a little bit about her story. I mean, she came from this little town in South Carolina. Her family came from India. They were sort of outsiders there. And they ended up kind of, in her telling, and this is a big piece of the narrative that she relies on, they sort of succeeded through the American dream. They had a clothing store. It was successful. She became this childhood accounting prodigy in the family store. But what you also see along the way is that she became quite adept at how to manage these different elements of her family story. And she would talk about the fact that she went to this school that had a black and white separate kickball teams, or that she was cast in the role, as she says, of Pocahontas in the Thanksgiving pageant. But how is she going to use that narrative in a Republican field that is at this point so neuralgic around race and is really not in a position to take what she's trying to do, which might be this kind of story of how that is her success, and situate that in a party that is, let's face it, at the moment, much more attracted to Donald Trump's race baiting, Donald Trump's transparent appeals to the worst instincts in American political culture. But, you know, just one note on her is she was known in South Carolina at some points as being so politically adept and kind of changeable that people described her as Bill Clinton in a skirt, which is to say, don't underestimate her political instincts. She can win people over in a way that you don't anticipate.
Well, it seems that the name everybody's really sort of talking about and waiting for is Governor Ron DeSantis of Florida, who is supposed to be actively preparing for a possible presidential run. Do you guys see him as Trump's Achilles heel?
Well, let's just say that this is the one that everybody is waiting for right now. And he's had a remarkable rise politically since becoming governor just a few years ago in 2018 during Trump's presidency. And by the way, this is one where you got to say that Trump actually, there's something to his grievance. He has already begun complaining about DeSantis and saying, hey, wait a minute, he'd be nothing without me. And there's actually a kind of a strong argument that that is the case. DeSantis was a very hard right Freedom Caucus member in the House of Representatives, running in a very crowded Republican primary and not winning until he decided to become the over-the-top pro-Trump candidate. And that was how he kind of rebooted his gubernatorial candidacy. He gets the endorsement from Trump. He runs, to me, an ad that everybody should watch, a campaign ad in which he used his two young children as pro-Trump props. Dad.
Ron loves playing with the kids.
Build the wall.
He reads stories.
Then Mr. Trump said, "You're fired." I love that part.
He dressed the baby in a Make America Great Again onesie and essentially marketed himself to Florida's voters. At the time, their Republican voters, extremely pro-Trump. It was very effective. So, you know, that origin story of DeSantis is very interesting, given that he and Trump are now sniping at each other as if it were going to be a two-person race. And by the way, it's very interesting if you look at the difference between how Donald Trump greeted the news of Nikki Haley announcing that she was running against him versus looking at how he is already jostling with Ron DeSantis. And basically, Trump is every day laying down some covering fire against DeSantis. But he said about Haley, well, she called me, you know, if that's what she feels like she has to do. And that tells you about the big difference between somebody who can actually challenge Trump right now for leadership of the race in the polls versus somebody like Nikki Haley, who's stuck in single digits.
Well, I mean, he was so patronizing, wasn't he, about Nikki Haley? You know, sure, hon, do whatever you like, follow your heart.
Yeah, no, exactly. I think in some ways he was damning her with faint praise. But I think when it comes to DeSantis, I mean, he goes right at him because he regards him, I think, as a threat. And if you look closely at what message DeSantis is trying to craft for himself, is he's trying to pull out this one string from Trump's bow, which is to say, I can be the fighter that Trump was without all of the baggage that goes with it. And that's supposed to be his attribute, is that he will fight for you. And that's partly, I think, a way of neutralizing what is this emerging sense that he's not a particularly likable guy. He's not a person that you come away from saying, gosh, he really, you know, I was the only person in the room when he was talking to me, or I had that kind of overwhelming sense of connection with him. He doesn't have that. So instead, if you make yourself as pugnacious as possible, then you may be able to draw out what it is that attracted people to Donald Trump. That's the theory, at least.
I mean, Haley has also said, I'm going to be the good of Trump without being the bad of Trump. And DeSantis is basically saying, I'm Trump without the chaos. I mean, in some ways, he's taken the culture wars even further than Trump did with these attacks on the AP course in African American history. I mean, these aren't even dog whistles anymore. These are like the noon whistle that the whole town has to hear. I mean, this is loud, what's going on in Florida in terms of sort of the racial signaling that's going on down there. I mean, you have to say, and I can see why Trump might be threatened by this, because because DeSantis won narrowly the first time when he ran, and he won overwhelmingly recently when he ran for re-election. So it seems to be working for him, right?
Yeah, a 19-point victory in what we would call a formerly battleground state is obviously a pretty significant win. And I think you're right, Jane, to the point about willingness to do things that even Trump wouldn't. Remember his stunt of shipping migrants from Florida to Martha's Vineyard. This is something that actually Donald Trump threatened to do throughout his presidency. Remember, he was talking about like the sanctuary cities in the blue states, and I'm going to send you these migrants. Donald Trump actually never did that, caused an outcry just by talking about doing that. And then you had DeSantis, who was willing to do it. But look, he is also untested nationally. You could say he's Trump without the chaos, but he also might be Trump without the charisma. Mm-hmm. And that's something that this process is going to draw out if he actually gets in. I was speaking the other day with longtime Republican operative. He said presidential campaigns are like the car wash. You go through 300 times. Ron DeSantis has only been through 3 times.
You know, there's another saying about state politicians, which is that they're kind of like sweet corn. And the further they get away from the garden they came from, the less sweet they taste. And so I don't know.
He's not starting out all that sweet to begin with. So it doesn't leave him much room to fall.
No, we don't.
I think we have to say that he is a remarkable example of what the kind of Republican PR information machine can do for somebody. There has been a sustained, and I mean sustained, effort across, say, the Murdoch media empire to turn Ron DeSantis into the putative heir apparent to Donald Trump and the next Republican nominee. He gets more airtime on Fox than any of the other would-be rivals. He is constantly featured for the last 2 years, really, in a pretty sustained way. And so I think many voters who are now registering him as either their first or their second choice in these Republican polls, what's striking is that they probably, their knowledge about DeSantis is not very deep. What they have been told is that he's Trump without the trouble. And that is a very uncertain proposition for somebody, because the voters are going to have to get to know him to a certain extent.
Yeah, and I think probably the reason you see the Murdoch empire and many other sort of parts of sort of the Republican establishment pushing towards DeSantis is the fear that there are going to be so many candidates jumping in that they will divide the field and they will be left with Trump. And so, as happened in 2016, and so there's sort of an effort you can kind of see for people to inch over and make another king if they possibly can, or crown one successor. In the batch of the others, does anybody think that Pompeo is really going to turn out to be a strong contender against his former boss? Susan, you profiled Pompeo. He's been talking about this higher calling. Yeah. What do you think?
I would not expect that Mike Pompeo would be a significant factor in this race. You know, he is, for a reason, in the coveted 1-3% of the field position starting out. Look, you know, Mike Pompeo is a classic example of the Trump cabinet in that he never in any other administration, a Republican or certainly Democrat, would have had the positions that he had. He was essentially an obscure 3-term congressman from Wichita, Kansas, never ran more than a single contested Republican primary race in terms of campaigning. To go from that and a few years as Donald Trump's courtier and Secretary of State to being a serious presidential contender is a very tough bar to cross. If you read, as I had the challenge of doing recently, his new, very undiplomatic memoir for a former Secretary of State called Never Give an Inch, what you will see is that Mike Pompeo is a very thin-skinned, pugnacious sort of a guy. And that does not combine all that well with presidential politics. What's really fascinating is that none of these former Trumpites, Nikki Haley, Mike Pence, Mike Pompeo, all three of them have been, according to our reporting, extremely willing to be critical of Donald Trump in private, or at least to disagree with him. None of them were on board with his post-2020 election effort to overturn the election results, or they all privately blame Trump for what happened on January 6th. And yet none of them, with the exception occasionally of Mike Pence, has had the courage to come out and publicly air those views. And Mike Pompeo's memoir, in fact, is a masterpiece of simply ignoring unpleasant facts, both about Donald Trump and about his own role in the Trump administration.
I find Pompeo kind of fascinating as a figure in this race, not because I think he's going to be president of the United States, as Susan says, he seems to be destined for that low single digits, but he is actually pointing us to some themes that are coming up in the policy discussion on the right. I think, you know, tonally, his book is this kind of venomous document. I mean, it's kind of, in some ways, the first shot of how this primary and eventually the campaign on the right has the feel of a kind of who can be angrier than the next. It's a kind of anger Olympics, really. And he is sort of trying to be the one who is most merciless about Democrats or about the press or about America's opponents. But on the policy side, what's fascinating is the role that he has made China in this, because Pompeo is building his candidacy around the idea that he is going to be the one that is willing to say the unsayable about China, the idea that that is, in some ways, America's future enemy. And, you know, other candidates are kind of edging up to that. But I remember having an interview with Steve Bannon, who is in so many ways unpleasant to deal with, but is not wrong about his own party. And what he said about the upcoming Republican primary was that it was going to be a contest about who can be more and more hawkish on China. And I think Pompeo has to be understood in that context.
The political scene will be back in just a moment.
Hi, it's David Remnick. If you're enjoying this podcast, you might enjoy even more of what The New Yorker has to offer. Becoming a subscriber gives you unlimited access to The New Yorker, including Pulitzer Prize-winning reporting, insightful cultural commentary, and fiction and poetry. You'll also enjoy our delightful cartoons, crossword puzzles, narrated stories, and much more. This past year, our readers were gripped by Ronan Farrow's profile of Elon Musk, Heidi Blake's extraordinary tale about Dubai's runaway princesses, and much more. Visit NewYorker.com to gain access to all this and more. Use the code POD15, P-O-D-1-5, to secure a 15% discount on a yearly digital subscription. That's POD15 for a 15% discount.
But we always have known that this was not the end. It was only the beginning of our fight to rescue the American dream. In order to make America great and glorious again, I am tonight announcing my candidacy for President of the United States.
So does this mean that the Republican Party is still the party of Trump even without Trump? Or does it mean that basically everyone's just waiting for Trump and that he still rules?
I think there was this fascinating set of statistics that came out of polling by Sarah Longwell, who is a never Trump Republican, who Susan wrote about. I really recommend everybody go back and look at that piece because it captures some of the process that Sarah followed as she sort of left the fold of the Republican Party. But what she does now, which is polls people who are Republicans who are grappling with their affection for Trump, and she found something very important. What she found is that Trump is this permanent piece of the furniture when it comes to attitudes. There's, in effect, this kind of floor that support will never go before, basically 28% to 30% of Republican primary voters. But she also found that they are attracted to Ron DeSantis. He would beat Trump in some of these head-to-head matchups. In some cases, you know, anybody but Trump was also getting into double digits. So what it really described is a trap for the Republican Party, which is that they've got this figure who is occupying a huge piece of the field and yet may not also have enough to be able to win. I think it's safe to say he's no more popular today than he was the last time he lost a presidential election, which was in 2020.
But the thing is, I agree. I think that that poll from the Bulwark, Sarah Longwell, was fascinating because it comes out at a time where Trump has said that he won't necessarily back whoever the Republican nominee is if it's not him. So you've got 28% of the Republican base that will stick with Trump if he runs as an independent. If he takes that chunk with him and doesn't back the Republican nominee, you've got the threat of a splintered Republican Party with a former president running. And the last time that I can think of that happening, I wasn't personally there, but 1912, when you had Teddy Roosevelt running. He had been president. He was a former president in 2012. And his successor, who was running at the time, Taft, he had disagreements with. And so at the last minute, he decided when Taft got the nomination that he would run as an independent. And he called himself a progressive candidate at that point. And so you had a former Republican president running against a incumbent president. And guess who won? The Democrat, Wilson. And you could be looking at something like this again.
We don't know yet what we don't know. But what we do know is that there is this hardcore following for Donald Trump, this passionate super fans that the poll and all the others have identified. And taking that into a contested multi-candidate field, it may actually still be enough to win, no matter how flawed Trump is or no matter how much the Republican establishment doesn't want him. Remember, they didn't want him in 2016 either, but they got him.
So how do cults of personality like this die?
Rarely quietly is the answer. I mean, I think the weird thing about Trump's candidacy right now is how dull and overlooked it is. I mean, let's be honest. In the early days when he was running in 2016 or even when he was running in 2020, there was a kind of energy about him and among his followers. And they felt in the first instance that they were being seen. And then when he ran in 2020, they felt like this was revenge for the ways in which they, and I'm obviously just piping their narrative here, that they felt as if they had been wronged. This time around, it's not as if that's the energy at all. And I think I should point out, I think the media has learned some lessons from the mistakes it made in 2016, which was just kind of shuffling along and listening to what Donald Trump said and doing his rallies on television. I mean, I think the press did take a beating, rightly, for that kind of behavior. And I think there is more of an understanding this time that the tools that he was able to use to manipulate the campaign are not as available to him. And as a result, you see him, he's about to take on a larger role on social media, has been restored to Twitter and Facebook and so on. But in some ways, the sort of lightning that he was able to capture the first time he ran is just exhausted now.
Well, you can certainly see that in his fundraising, which is very interesting. It's the mother's milk of politics. And there you are. He's raised very little since he got into this presidential race this time. Since November, it's like less than $10 million, $9.5 million, I think, which is, you know, just a little over $200,000 a day. That's anemic, really. You know, Jeb Bush, when he was running, was taking in just under $800,000 a day, and Hillary Clinton was taking in just under $600,000 a day, and even Mitt Romney was getting over $600,000 a day. So Trump is somebody, one Republican consultant described him as having driven a Ferrari last time, and now he's stuck running around in a lawnmower engine. And it's puttering along, but not very healthily.
I think, one thing we haven't talked about is the Democratic Party, which, after all, is right, waiting quietly, and I think quite hopefully, for Donald Trump to be the front runner in the Republican side. Look, there's just no other way to put it. He is God's gift to Democrats because it's risky. It's scary. You never know quite what's going to happen when you're squaring off against him in a campaign. But he is also, at this point, a proven loser several times over, and they know how to run against him. And that's one of the reasons, I think, why you heard when Ron Klain, the outgoing chief of staff from the White House, was leaving, you know, he made a big public point to say, we'll see Joe Biden in the race in 2024. And then he also said in an interview with me that right now, Donald Trump is the front runner, and anybody who thinks that Joe Biden can't beat him better be able to make a damn good case for who can.
But when it comes to sort of praying for Trump again to be the front runner, all I can say is remember 2016. That's what the Democrats were hoping for then, too. So it's not a guarantee.
Be careful what you wish for.
It's as risky as you can get, except that looking at some of these other candidates, they might be better able to exploit some of the Democrats' vulnerabilities. That's the theory of the case.
Well, until next week, and this is going to be an incredibly interesting campaign. I think that much we can be absolutely certain about, if nothing else. So anyway, thank you guys so much.
Thanks, Jane.
Thank you, Jane.
This has been The Political Scene, and I'm Jane Mayer. We had production assistance today from Alex D'Elia and Emily Elias. Stephen Valentino is our executive producer. Our theme music is by Allison Leighton Brown. Thanks so much for listening. We'll see you next week.